in between these things. Now, once you have such a theory, you need to show that it is good, which means that you need to show that from your quantum sum over geometries, you can get a continuum or an approximation, a continuum limit or a continuum approximation that is the physics that we know. So the way that this is understood, roughly speaking, is that from the full theory, you need to find what are the dominant, the neoclassical geometries. And then it's usually a straightforward step how to go from those to the continuum approximation. But how to go from the full theory to the configurations that are dominant is a part that is not straightforward at all. So there is, in most approaches, there is a bunch of proposals for what these are, but not really derived, such as weave states, coherent states, and so on. In the case of causal dynamical triangulations, you can actually do this step and get to the typical configurations. And then, depending on the different approaches, you have a way to get the continuum limit. Now, why there are lots of dots here in most of these approaches? Well, of course, I mean, I could be giving a whole talk on what the issues are. And this is, as I said, a cartoon, so we can discuss this much greater length at some other point. But broadly speaking, you're paying a price for wanting to be background independent and having this quantum sum over geometries. So in general, you have a trouble identifying a low energy limit or equivalent to defining a ground state when you have a constrained system. Or another thing that you might try to do is get to the low energy by some coarse graining method, mimicking what you usually do in statistical physics. But there is a thing that you're missing. So in statistical physics, there is this beautiful miracle that the lattice corresponds to the observables. So coarse graining the lattice means that I coarse grain the observables. And that happens for free in statistical physics. But for us, the observables are very non-trivial objects, as you will all know. In a background independent theory like GR or a quantum version of it, coarse graining the observables is not easy because you do not know what the observables are. So here I want to discuss a possibility that you could do the following. You could have a fundamental theory that is a quantum theory, but still have only one spacetime rather than sum over spacetimes, and that can only be the classical one. So there is no superposition of spacetimes. So I just in case you get excited, I don't actually know quite how to do this. But I do know how to break it into parts. And that's, we've been trying to clarify this for quite a while now with, oh, I've actually come from different directions, but then we realize we're doing the same thing. And what I plan to do here is give you steps of how that could be done and what it would involve. So here is what I really want to do. So if I take seriously the point of the previous talk that photons are emergent, and I combine it with what general relativity says, which is that only events are physical. The geometry is a way of organizing the events. And events are things like the coincidence of the photons. But now the photons are emergent. So what I ought to conclude is that spacetime, which can only be the result of the interaction of the photons, and everything else, of course, must also be emergent. And my claim is that if you believe the first part, then you have to take the second one too. So let's see then, what would that mean? What would you have to do? Well, you would have to start with some fundamental theory that has nothing to do with space-time. From that, you need to look at the emergent degrees of freedom that are relevant in the very cold world we live in, as Grisha was saying in the morning. And from those, you form space-time, and you should get gravity out, and you should only get one. So in a little more detail, I could start from a string network, which, by the way, is the same as a spin network, look for the excitations of this object under some Hamiltonian, and we've just seen one that would give you desired excitations. And now from the interactions of these excitations, I can get a single causal set, only one. And then the task would be, there is nothing too hard in getting to this point. And now that you have the single gas, what you want to do is this to be the space-time with the Einstein equation satisfied. Could you actually do that? So the rest of the talk breaks this down into what you would need to show in order to do this.
Excuse me, I have a question here. Suppose you have a two gapless mode with a different velocity, then whether it will be a problem of defining causal set if you have a two gapless mode with different velocity, then whether you require all the gapless stations have a single velocity to, in order to proceed to define this causal set space-time method. I try to understand.
I only wonder about the interactions of those. So I'm not completely sure what you're worried
because
about.
Because causal set, I don't know, I think my answer is related to the Lorentz interference.
A causal set is just a partial order of interaction. So you have your photons and they can interact with each other, and I just keep track of the interactions, and that gives me a partial order. So that's all I need. I don't need to, I mean, this is not embedded anywhere, it's just a partial order.
Well, the nucleus photons have the same spin from the set of fingers. So get a finger. What was the speed of light of the system?
I see.
So the first part here is what do you mean by fundamental free space-time theory? So I normally know how to get emergent degrees of freedom in a condensed matter model, like the ones that we have been shown today. So in solid state physics, I have lattices that are in a space-time. Now, as I'm sure the condensed matter physicists already say, well, that is not really so important. But can you show that? So I'd say that one can reformulate the solid state construction to a manifestly background in event form. And I will do that by using the tool of quantum information theory. I'm not going to do any new physics here. All I'm really saying is that a dynamical quantum system can be viewed as a quantum information processing system. And I will use that to clarify what aspects of background are important. And also, I will for free get some good tools to use. So the claim is that a necessary reference to geometry can be eliminated using the language of quantum information processing. And in that world, there is a natural role for the low energy limit that I would claim is the notion of encoding. Yes.
When is the background independent? You still need information of background and time.
Yes.
To understand.
Yes. I'll come to that. That was, I had a couple more lines here. So if you wait, I'll get to that. So first of all, I want to understand what this means and bring it to a state that can actually be used. So the immediate questions I would like to understand is, what do I mean here? What is a quantum information processing system? What is encoding? And what does this have to do with low energy physics? The thing to keep at the back of your mind is that if you think that you want to go from a Planck scale theory to quantum field theory, which you would need to, then what your task that you're facing is to coarse grain 20 orders of magnitude and be left with a unitary theory. So if you come from a perspective like the coherence, the question is, why do you get anything at all left? Why doesn't the whole world just spread out into nothing that lives long at all? OK, so let's go from the beginning. A quantum information processing system is nothing deep, is a sequence of quantum operations that you can perform on quantum systems. So here you could, if your persuasion, or to connect with what I said before, is causal sets, what I have here is a partial order. The way that you normally think of that in the context of quantum information theory is a circuit, and it's the same object. And what it says is that I can go between quantum systems using quantum physical operations that go under the name of a quantum channel. So what this is simply evolution written as a linear map from the operators that can act to the system before and go to a new system after. There are certain conditions on this map that correspond to be a physical operation, and in particular, it should be a completely positive map. That is, it should be positive because you want it to go from density matrices to density matrices, keeping the eigenvalues positive. But also, if you trivially extend it to a larger system, you also want this composite map to be positive. Here, this I'm not really going to need for the main discussion of this talk, but I would like to point out that this is just evolution of quantum open systems. So again, I'm not bringing in new physics, but I am bringing new tools. So evolution in that form can be written, and by the way, I'm talking about finite dimensional systems everywhere in this talk, as a set of operators of matrices, so that I can expand the evolution in this form given a set of matrices called the Parse operators that I can actually use to do good things later on. So just to convince you that this is the same physics as I had before, you can see that a special case of a quantum information processing system is a quantum geometry that some of you know and love. So when you go from an initial quantum geometry on a spin network to a new one, what you're really doing is local operations on pieces of the graph that gives the state before, and you change it locally to the state after. So all these operations I can do give me, if you like, the circuit. And the usual amplitude to go from the initial to the final state can be simply written down as the product of the local evolution on open systems, which are what subgraphs really are.
Yes? Does the total dimension of Hilbert space conserve under this operation? But the Hilbert space has a growing dimension, looks like.
That depends on what you're doing.
The formalism allows that to happen.
You can do that.
If it's not unitary. Yes. The local operators are not unitary.
Now, this is basically the same picture as I had before, minus the sum over histories. So if I just remove the sum over histories, what do I have? Well, I have a string network, or if you like, a spin network, or the evolution. So the only thing I need is the network that now is my condensed matter system should not have any symmetries that presuppose a space-time. Right. So if it has things like translational symmetries, then I've put in space that I didn't need. But if you're willing to give me a condensed matter model on random lattice, then that's fine. If I'm modeling a condensed matter model as a quantum information processor, then I will clearly not have the sum over histories. There is just one Hamiltonian, one evolution, and therefore one time, going back to what Laurent was saying. Now, the part where it gets more interesting is to discuss low energy physics in that context. That's the reason that I'm really doing this translation into our quantum information language. So this is not meant to be taken literally, but it's a simple illustration of how to view low energy physics, emergence of low energy physics as encoded. So what I have here is a usual classicalizing model. So I have a chain of spins that can be up or down. And I want to think in a physical way of what I normally do when I force grain. So what do I do? When I pull string, it means that I care about the physics at large scales compared to my system. So physically, that would mean that I can probe the system with some observables or some other machine whose characteristic wavelength is much larger than the lattice spacing of my system. So now let me look at my operators on the system as a way that I could actually mess it up. So what this outside world does is that it could really flip the spins. But the fact that I'm looking at the world at large wavelengths compared to my lattice spacing means that if I flip this, chances are I'll flip its neighbor. I'm now looking at the low energy physics as, if you like, putting the system in an environment that can change the system, but at a characteristic wavelength that is larger than the envelope of the system. So now how about I do this simple transformation? Where I had the two spin degrees of freedom before, I can consider, instead of the first one, I can consider the parity of the two, which happens to also have the same plus or minus one value. And so I can define the parity to be a new degree of freedom. And the point is that while I could flip the spin of the system, the parity will remain unchanged. So it's the part that is relevant at larger scales. So a way that I could physically think of force training is eliminating these noisy degrees of freedom and keeping the preserved ones. And the reason I have preserved ones is a length scale discrepancy between my underlying system and the low energy physics. That's what I mean by low energy physics. So another way to say this is that low energy physics means difference in relevant length scales, and that induces a symmetry of the system, which is what I'm using when I force train. So, but that was a classical system. The situation is, of course, more interesting in a quantum system. And I would like to repeat the exercise for a quantum system. And this is a standard example of quantum error correction. That I also want to claim the same thing as extracting low energy physics, just in a very idealized way, admittedly. So we'll go back and discuss it. So what do I have here? I have my system is now 3 qubits in an external magnetic field. Now, the external magnetic field plays the same role as what I had before. The characteristic wavelength of that is much larger than the spacing between my qubits. So it can flip them, it's noisy, but chances are it will flip them all the same way. In other words, if I wrote down an interaction Hamiltonian for this system, it would have this form where the rotation operators on the qubits act collectively on all three. So the interaction of this system is symmetric under permutation of three spins. And that lets me do the following thing. The state space I started with is, of course, 3 qubits. But now let me decompose it in terms of the reducible representations of this system. So I have 3 halves split into 2 one-halves plus a 3-half. Yes. And the point is that the evolution here, what it does is that it acts identically on the 2 half parts. So that is, if you chose a basis on this part of the state space, where 1 degree of freedom tells you whether you're up or down, and the other tells you whether which one of the 2 halves you're in, right? So one tells you if you're here, one is a degree of freedom for this part, and the other is a degree of freedom here. Then it turns out that while one is noisy, so you can flip them, there is a protected part. You can't tell on which of the 2 blocks of your decomposition you're in. You can flip them around, but you will flip both of them the same way, both of the 2 blocks the same way. So the, this part of the system ends up being unaffected by this evolution. And that is another way to say that, is that I can write the evolution as flipping the system times the identity on this protected part of the state space, which you therefore call the noiseless part. So there is a part of the system, because of the symmetry, which again is because I'm looking at scales that are much larger than the relevant one for the system, that behaves as an effective coherent degree of freedom. Just to sum up what I was saying, is that if I have an evolution given as a channel on my state space, I can find a decomposition of it. So these are the irreducible representations I had before, and this is the decomposition inside the half that I was looking at, such that this part will be noiseless under this evolution if this equation is satisfied, which simply says that the system splits into two parts. This one gets all the noise, so it's transformed into something new. That one is left noiseless, so I can keep this. Now, the reason that the quantum information people are interested in that is that they could encode useful information here and extract it later. But that's not what I care about. What I care about is that this you can think of as a propagating coherent degree of freedom. And if by noise what you mean is a microscopic evolution, which might be Planckian or whatever it is in your string network, then this object can describe your emergent degrees of freedom. So so the claim that I'm making is that if you go through this path of the quantum information language, then you can do things like have a quantum, an evolving quantum system, and also discuss low energy physics without making reference to a background, except for a time. There is always a time. There is, of course, a time here. But we'll come back to what that means. But there is no, you don't need lattice spacing. You don't need to say that this side is 2 centimeters away from this one. That all goes into the form of the evolution.
But the meaning of the distance may survive after became a protective information. That's the message here. The spatial separation.
I would like to use that in a system where the underlying system has some set of couplings, but that they don't have anything to do with spatial separations. You could use it in a system that has spatial separation is significant, but that's not what I want to apply to. I just say that one way that you could, now the question is, of course, how does space-time come out of that? This suggests a possibility, but that's not the one I want to pursue for today, that you could, once you have excitations, you could also put the transformations that you want that mean that they live in a space-time inside the condition for it being a noiseless subsystem. So I could, for example, say that I could get flat space from noiseless subsystems by extending the notion to a group invariant noiseless subsystem, where, for example, an interesting incarnation would be a Poincaré invariant noiseless subsystem, where my protected degree of freedom, the U should be on this part, my protected degree of freedom is allowed to undergo a Poincaré transformation and stays the same protected degree of freedom. But that's not really what I want to do today. I want to continue on how to realize the plan that I outlined. So here, let me then go back to what Laurent was saying. The statement is that you can reformulate a solid state construction to a manifestly background independent form as long as there are no spatial symmetries, such as translation invariance, and modulo the time in the fundamental Hamiltonian that I will discuss in a little while. Now, the crux of the matter. Why would you have Einstein equations, and why would you have a four-dimensional smooth geometry? Well, so one thing is to note that you actually have to answer these questions in the previous version where you have a sum over all histories. By having a sum over all histories, you don't actually explain this. Anybody has to answer that. At least here I only have one history, which you might think it makes it harder. I think it might make it easier. OK, so what could you hope for? Well, so the construction here that is discussed is that you will use excitations and their interactions. And that's all you have. And from those, you will define both the geometry and whatever the Timian U is. And the conjecture one makes is that if you do this consistently, then the geometry and the Timian U will not be independent, but will satisfy Einstein's equations as identities. And Seth's computational universe is a realization of such a conjecture. Now, we are zooming into what Laurent is worried about. Is this really background independent? Well, let's break that down into parts. So usually what you mean by background independent is that one theory of gravity says background independent if its basic quantities and concepts do not presuppose the existence of a given background metric. Now, the microscopic theory is modulo the time of the Hamiltonian. I keep pushing that to later and later. Trivially background independent in that it's not supposed to be geometric. It's just some abstract quantum network. Now, your task would be to show that the emergent physics is background independent with respect to the internally defined relational geometry, which, of course, if you could realize the conjecture that I had in the box before, you would be achieving. So what about that time in the fundamental Hamiltonian? Now, what you should be worried about is that this could lead to a preferred reference frame or some other experimental conflict. Now, before we discuss it further, you know that you have a huge advantage by having a real Hamiltonian, a real time. You have a meaningful ground state. You can actually do, you can use the standard understanding of low energy physics in a straightforward way, which is unclear how to do that in a constrained system. So, now, the main point is that there is no reason that the time in the Hamiltonian has to be the same as the time in the space-time geometry you would be reconstructing inside the system from the excitations. Here I have a suggestion, which is really Thomas Konopka's suggestion, on how, just pushing further this idea of noiselessness and quantum information perspective on this, how you might actually be able to get a constraint where there was none. So here I've rewritten the, so in my previous form, this is the state on the full space. So AB is the state on two parts of the system. And again, the B part gets all the noise and the A is left unchanged through an equation of that type. Now, let's concentrate on a very simple case where these matrices here are one-dimensional. So what I would have is my evolution on the system would give it a phase and get the other system back. And in that case, I call these operator stabilizers. Well, one calls these operator stabilizers, I should say. Now, let's compare that with something else, with constraints. So what are constraints? What is the Dirac formula? Well, you have a kinematical state space on which you have an algebra of constraints satisfying the usual relations. And what we normally look for is the physical states, that are those that are annihilated by the constraints. And that defines your physical state space. And the observables in a constraint theory are Dirac observables, which are the objects that commute with the constraints. Now, there is something very simple you can do. You can note that this equation here can be rewritten in a very simple form, where just this is some complex number, lambda, so that it looks like a stabilizer equation. Now, here is an extremely simple example that illustrates what you would be doing. So I have a particle in two dimensions, and my constraint is that the momentum in the y direction is zero. So on the kinematical state space, the generic state would have this form. But the constraint means that basically only the x component of the momentum can be non-zero. So your intuition is that these type of states are in the physical state space. Now, I can just rewrite my constraint as a stabilizer. So I've just extended the equation I had before in a very simple way. Now, but this has an interesting, I mean, it's a very simple thing to do, right? It's basically trivial. But it has, what is it that you really did? Well, what you're saying is that a constraint system can be viewed as a 2D particle coupled to an environment. So I can think of now the system I had before as coupled to some environment, I don't care what it is. And the coupling has this form, which, if you look at it a little carefully, is the same as this. So what happens is that my constraint system, you can think of it as a sector of this bigger system. And of course, what's going on here is that if I now make a unitary evolution, a unitary operator out of this interaction Hamiltonian, then clearly it has the property I want, that it acts identically on the physical states. So this gives you the possibility that where you had a constraint system before, you can replace it with a system with a true Hamiltonian, but one that interacts with an environment. Probably what you're doing here is this, that you normally think of evolution as a system that follows a pattern of configuration space. Now, symmetry means that only certain paths in the configuration space are selected. That's quite similar to constraints, which provide a mechanism that implements a restriction on the allowed paths in configuration space. And noiselessness relates these conditions to the dynamics. It says that part of the quantum system are unchanged by interactions with the environment. So what one is doing is relating this. And I'm saying that it is possible that I can get a constraint theory out of something that has a true Hamiltonian. And the price I have to pay is that my spacetime, if you like, the world of the spacetime, has to interact with an environment, which is a very weird thing to do in general if you think that all there is in the universe is a geometry, that the universe is a geometry. For example, if you thought that pure gravity makes sense, you would not be able to prove that. But if, in the context that I'm in, where I already have an underlying theory, I can think of the underlying condensed matter-like model as my environment, the high energy degrees of freedom, then I can do that. I already have an environment. So it is possible that you can deal with that time in an interesting way. Okay. Almost finally. So what is the significance of the underlying theory? So if you like, why don't I just do what Seth does, or I just have an evolving system, and then I make this internal assignment of geometry, and I get the Einstein equations out. Why do I care about the theory that it came from? Well, what you should you could do is compare the way that we usually think of emergence baseline through some sort of coarse graining versus what opens up here, the possibility of a phase transition. So in normal quantum gravity theories that are quantum geometry theories, you have the events, if you like, at Planck scale, and then your intuition is that they bunch together to make, events at larger scale. Now, here, photons in the previous talk are given as topological excitations. And similarly, noiseless subsystems have a similar property that they're everywhere in the underlying system. They're not part of the system. So that means that you have here, you have an underlying locality structure that really is preserved. It's just coarse grained when you go towards the continuum. While here, they're very different. You can have local dynamics in the underlying theory, but you go through a phase transition, you end up with excitations that can have a very different, you have different excitations and therefore a different local structure. So that has to have consequences. It does change the way that you think of the spacetime in these contexts. So one thing is that you have to rethink what the role of the Planck length is here. It's not clear that the underlying theory has to be at Planck scale or anything like that. Second, of course, you can have observable consequences or remnants of the phase transition. And here is a conjecture. So if you have if you're faced with something like the horizon problem, then how would you see it through this perspective? Well, you would say that you have a phase transition after which the space-time makes sense, before which there was a universe that was not described in a geometric way. So in the before, you have the excitations before with a local structure before. In the after, you have excitations after with a local structure after. So you're sitting here, and you're looking backwards, and you see correlations that you cannot explain with a local structure here. But since there was a phase transition you went through, that doesn't mean anything. You wouldn't actually expect to. Now, that is, of course, not enough. You would like to know if the underlying model gives specific signatures that then you can pick up. But the interesting part for me is that the existence of a phase transition gives you the possibility that your quantum gravity effects are not at Planck scale. These are large-scale effects that could arise. And finally, I mean, that's a point that Ola has made, that this path of going from free space-time to excitations to a space-time can remove problems that can be traced to space-time being fundamental or having a fundamental theory of quantum geometry, like the cosmological constant problem. And I don't have time to go into that. Final question. Doesn't strict theory do what you want? Isn't that a theory of an emerging space-time from something? Well, depends what you mean again. Strictly speaking, in the usual form, string theory is not background independent. It's strings in a background. So now you have to do some exercise and then tell me that it doesn't matter what background you're in. And I guess you already had to do that with the condensed matter model. So I mean, I actually would like to have these things clear of what background matters where. But just to say that things like matrix models are very close to the present proposal. And I'm out of time. And I think I'm going to stop here. Thank you.
Then time for one or two very quick questions. Lots of some other things to discuss and discuss on the weekend.
And nobody has a problem with that.